Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why state lawmakers are looking at long agendas this week.
And a Goldwater Institute-backed lawsuit challenging an ASU DEI training.
But first, a federal judge is taking control of Arizona's prison health care system away from the state and giving it to a court-appointed receiver. In a ruling late last week, Judge Rosalind Silver noted complaints that have gone back more than a decade and promises from the state to improve both physical and mental health care in its prisons. But she wrote, quote, "After nearly 14 years of litigation with defendants not having gained compliance or even a semblance of compliance with the injunction and the Constitution, this approach has not only failed completely, but if continued, would be nothing short of judicial indulgence of deeply entrenched unconstitutional conduct," end quote. In a statement, the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry says it strongly disagrees with the ruling as it disregards the immense progress that has been made and promises an appeal. David Fati is director of the ACLU's National Prison Project and one of the lawyers representing the prisoners in this case. He's on the line now. David, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So I want to ask first off about sort of the timing of this, because as we mentioned, this has been going on for quite a while. What do you think it was now that led the judge to finally say enough is enough?
Well, we have to start with the fact that, as you say, this case has been going on for 14 years. And in all of that time, the state has never been in compliance with the court's orders to provide minimally adequate health care to incarcerated people. So after 14 years of litigation, almost 3 years after the court entered an injunction that the state agreed to, I think Judge Silver finally decided that more stringent measures were necessary.
So what do you make of the State Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry basically saying, look, we have made some progress in the last 3 years. We've added healthcare staff. We have introduced new programming, things like that. Like, does that do you see that? Does that make any progress to you?
There have been improvements, and Judge Silver acknowledges them, but people are still suffering and dying right now, today, because of grossly inadequate medical care. We're talking about a court order that the state agreed to almost 3 years ago, and the state admits it is nowhere close to complying with it. When people's lives are at stake, partial compliance just isn't good enough.
So what do you think the receivership looks like? Like, what actually changes when this actually goes into effect?
Well, Judge Silver hasn't yet decided on the scope of the receiver's power. She's asked both sides to submit our positions on that question, and then she'll make a decision. But generally speaking, the receiver's job will be to administer the prison healthcare system so as to come into compliance with the court's orders and the Constitution, something that state officials have unfortunately been unwilling or unable to do. The receiver is essentially an administrator. Judge Silver has dozens of cases. She can't spend all her time on this one case. A receiver will be someone who is focused on this one case to make sure the state does what it needs to do to finally come into compliance with the Constitution.
Do you have a sense of what kinds of terms you're going to be asking for?
We're going to be asking for fairly broad powers for the receiver to be able to do what is necessary to finally bring the state into compliance. The receiver is an agent of the court. The receiver doesn't have any greater powers than the court. But let me give you one example. Mm-hmm. There's been a persistent problem with incarcerated people being seen by outside specialists if they need to see a cardiologist, a gastroenterologist, etc. There's a state law that caps how much outside specialists can be paid, and the state has acknowledged that that law is a barrier to providing adequate care. So the receiver might be given the power to waive that law so that the specialist can be paid adequately and people can get the medically necessary health care that they need.
So, I mean, what would it actually take to comply with the court order and the Constitution? I mean, you're saying you're asking for fairly broad powers. It seems like it would take an awful lot to bring the state into compliance here.
Well, the single most fundamental problem throughout the life of this case has always been inadequate healthcare staffing. The prison system doesn't have enough adequately qualified staff to take care of the people it incarcerates. The court has said this, the neutral court experts have said this, and the state doesn't disagree. And even today, almost 3 years after the court issued its injunction, which the state agreed to, the prison system's healthcare contractor hasn't even filled all the staff positions that are required under the current contract, let alone the additional staff that the court experts have said are necessary to come into compliance. So there is a long way to go.
Do you have a sense of how much all of this might cost?
Well, the cost of the receiver itself is pretty insignificant. In California, whose prison system is about four times the size of Arizona, the receivership costs about $3 million a year. And even if we assume that it costs that much in Arizona, that's less than 1/5 of 1% of the prison system's $1.7 billion annual budget. And it's certainly much less than they're spending fighting this case in court. So to focus on the cost of the receivership is really a red herring.
All right. So you mentioned California. Have things gotten better in prisons there with that system in receivership?
Yes, the receivership of the California prison medical care has been a resounding success. Medical care has greatly improved to the point where the receiver has now returned control of 31 out of 35 prisons back to the Department of Corrections. So after years of dysfunction and suffering and death, the receivership has turned the system around and has given control back to the state.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is David Fatti with the ACLU's National Prison Project, the director of that project. David, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Today marks the beginning of crossover week at the state capitol when the House starts in earnest sending its bills across the mall to the Senate and vice versa. That means lawmakers will have long agendas and lots of bills to vote on in the coming days. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session with a look ahead to the next several days, is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. Another wonderful week here at the Capitol.
Indeed. So let's talk about briefly the importance of crossover week. I guess a lot of bills that, you know, the lawmakers had hoped to keep moving at the end of last week are no longer moving.
Well, some of them are not. You know, remember that there were like over 1,100 bills introduced in the House. I think there were 800 in the Senate, even though there were half as many members there. And there's a certain process where things get kind of, you know, filtered, and things that don't get heard, things that die in committee. What's happening now is now the full House and the full Senate are getting a look at these things and deciding, do we really want to move these things forward? At this point, most things sponsored by Republicans will move forward. Even if there are flaws in it, the usual attitude is, well, we'll fix it when it goes to the Senate or something like that.
Yeah.
But it is a filtering process of sorts. It does give people a chance to find out a little bit more about the bills. They get to ask questions of the sponsors. That doesn't always mean the sponsors will answer the questions, because that isn't the requirement. But again, it is a chance to go ahead and figure, what are the priorities going to be? How many bills are they're going to try to get through the process? How many are they going to send to the governor? And perhaps more of the point, how many of these are the governor going to veto? I mean, you know, so far this year, she has vetoed 11 and signed only 3. So at the rate we're going, I'd say we're headed for yet another record.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the bills that the Senate will be debating this week would expand the list of impeachable offenses for the governor and other folks. What else do they want to be able to impeach governors and judges and other statewide elected officers for?
Well, the current constitutional requirements talk about things like high crimes and misdemeanors, things like that. This would say we can impeach somebody if they fail to follow or enforce a state law or a court ruling. Now, that's sort of a nebulous kind of thing because, you know, has somebody violated the law? Well, give me 3 attorneys, I'll give you 7 opinions as to whether that law has been violated. Same thing with court rulings. But this is the brainchild of Senator Wendy Rogers, one of the more conservative lawmakers down there. And she contends that the governor is ignoring the law, the attorney general is ignoring the law, the judges are ignoring the law, and this would provide an avenue for lawmakers to go ahead and do an impeachment. Now, remember, it simply takes a majority of the House to file bills of impeachment and do the impeachment. It takes a two-thirds vote of the Senate to actually convict someone and remove them from office. I'd say that that's a virtual impossibility. So I'm not sure what you accomplish here, other than perhaps having something that you can hold over the head of the governor saying, if you don't do this, we will impeach you. I mean, this isn't sort of like what happened in Washington with Clinton and then with Trump, where, you know, they were trying to score, I think, political points. And again, as we saw in Washington, ultimately, all of that went nowhere.
Yeah. So, Howie, there is a bill going through the House Appropriations Committee this week, today, actually, that requires schools to spend 60% of their money on teacher salaries. And there's punishment for those that don't?
Exactly. There's been a report prepared now by the Auditor General's office now for over two decades. And they separated out into instructional stuff, which is teacher salaries and things like that and fringe benefits, administrative, certain support services like librarians, transportation, utilities. And the argument has been, we really need 60% spent on teacher salaries, which is a nice goal. The problem has been also that the Auditor General says we've actually been going in the wrong direction. Some of that is that we actually have fewer kids in schools, yet you still have certain fixed costs. And so this is designed to say, if you do not hit 60%, tell you what, we're going to give you a few years to take 0.5% a year to try to get there. If you don't get there, we're going to withhold state aid. Now, I'm not sure how withholding state aid from a district that's having problem getting teacher salaries up solves the problem. But again, it's designed to shed light on the problem. One of the problems, of course, has begun, and I know I keep using the word problem, but that's so much of what happens here is that way, is that there are things that you cannot change. I mean, you've got a rural district, you have large transportation costs.
Right.
If you have a district that's in Flagstaff, you have heating costs. A district down here has cooling costs. And so you come into some questions of, while the teacher salaries have been increasing, nobody doubts salaries have been going up. But as a percentage of the whole, which is the way they choose to measure it, they haven't kept pace with everything else. One other important thing to point out is that when you compare administrative costs, pure administrative costs in Arizona overall with other states, we're actually below the average of other states. But that doesn't seem to be impressing anybody.
Howie, one more bill I want to ask you about is coming up for a vote in the House this week. And it would require that parents who use their kids in videos, presumably on social media or YouTube or something like that, who make money off of those videos would have to set aside some percentage of the money for the kids when they turn 18?
Yep. No more freelancing off your kids. No more, you know, getting that new washer dryer paid for by the kids. This is actually modeled after a national thing called Coogan's Law, which is named after a child actor named Jackie Coogan, whose parents spent all of his money and basically left him destitute. This says that if your kid is appearing in 30% of your videos, you know, because they're doing something cute, oh, that's nice, so let's get clicks on that. Or they'll show them opening up boxes, let's say, of Hasbro toys, and Hasbro will then pay money to have that out there, that you can't just spend it on yourself. You know, the true star of this is the child. And so they need to set aside at least 50% of the money for the child when he or she turns 18 and ensure that they're actually benefiting from their own efforts, their own talents. I mean, I recognize a three-year-old may not recognize, oh, this is work, but it is.
Yeah.
And so there's nothing wrong. The lawmakers are saying, and I think it's been proved unanimously at this point, that yes, it's only fair that the kids share in this. Now, you theoretically could go to a judge and say, well, Your Honor, we have some special expenses here, and the judge might be able to excuse it. But in general, that those dollars would be inviolate.
All right. Lots to keep our eyes on. As always, that is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you.
Have a great morning.
Good morning. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a third-generation South Phoenician is exploring how to maintain her family's identity and connection after the passing of their matriarch.
But first, during the pandemic, journalist Maritza Felix noticed something. There was a wide gulf, it seemed to her, between the way people were talking about COVID in the mainstream media and on her family WhatsApp thread. Information being shared through formal channels wasn't translating, and so she set out to create a place where it would. That's how Conecta Arizona was born. It started out as a WhatsApp discussion group and has grown into a multi-pronged media organization. One of its main outlets is a radio show hosted by Maritza called La Hora del Cafecito, or Coffee Time.
Mi gente bonita, muy buenos días, ¿cómo están? Bienvenidos y bienvenidas a La Hora del Cafecito de Conecta Arizona, ahora en una edición especial.
The show recently celebrated its five-year anniversary, and we invited Maritza to the studio last week to talk about why the show continues to resonate with its listeners.
What we try to do is those conversations that we have had in WhatsApp, just to put them in a microphone and give the community the platform to actually ask questions, be part of the conversations, understand the news, have a place where they can ask about what is going on outside without being judged.
Why is that particular facet of it important to you? What does that mean in a practical sense?
When Conecta Arizona was founded, it was inspired by my mom, who's a very well-educated person, who thought that baking soda, hot water, and lemon were going to cure us from coronavirus. And she's very well-educated. And I told her, it's like, Mom, I don't think this is how it works. So I created the WhatsApp first, a place that she felt that she could ask those questions without feeling dumb. And La Hora del Cafecito en el Radio, that's a place where they can actually ask those questions and they can feel that they belong and they don't feel judged because there is a community that was thinking just the same as they did. And now it's like they have a place where experts can answer their questions directly without judging and understanding their culture. That's how kind of La Hora del Cafecito was born. It's like mixing a little bit of coffee, a little bit of sugar, a little bit of crema, a little bit of everything.
Well, I have to imagine there has been so much rapid change when it comes to immigration policy and enforcement, particularly since President Trump was inaugurated for the second time. And with that has come a torrent of misinformation about what resources people have available to them, perhaps pre-existing resources that are no longer reliable, that sort of thing. This value of not judging people for the questions that they ask and the needs that they have must be urgent in that sense as well.
And not judging them for the political preference that they have. So embracing difficult conversations has been key for us. It is missing disinformation, but it's also polarization. We do a lot of research with our community, and we understand that we serve a very diverse Latino community. Some of them, they're really rooting and supporting this president, and some of them aren't. So getting them exposed to different point of views is very, very important for us. And do it in a way that we are embracing those conversations from curiosity, not from confrontation or friction. I think the political climate that we're living right now is making us notice a little bit more our differences and not what actually makes us unique as a community, as a Latino community. One of the most powerful and strong communities that we have in Arizona.
When you have listeners who get in touch with you who are supportive of the president, what kinds of things do they say that they are supportive of?
Economy. They do believe that the way that the president is doing things is getting more money into their pockets. We just recently did this interview with this Salvadorian guy who has a restaurant in Southern Arizona, and he was providing free meals for ICE officers and CBP. And then he's married to a Mexican, so the menu is completely Latin food. He was saying, it's like, we are rooting for this president. Maybe we don't precisely back up the way that he does immigration enforcement, but we like everything else. I think what they want to support is a sense of belonging, a sense that they already made it to this country, a sense that they have assimilated into the system.
Can you share it all, Maritza? For you, how do you prepare for moments like that? Because I have to imagine it's the host of the show. Mm-hmm. You're in a delicate position because you want to feel like you are everyone's proxy who is listening. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I don't know if that's how you feel, but you don't want to feel, I imagine, like you're only there for people who feel a certain way or people who don't feel a certain way. So walk me through what's going through your mind as you have a conversation like the one with this restaurant owner you were just describing.
It is hard because I just recently became a U.S. citizen a year ago. And for a longer time, I thought that my identity, that was something that it needed to be detached from the work that I did as journalist. Now I understand that my identity, being an immigrant as well, is a huge part of who I am and what I do, and it's kind of our superpower. Connect Arizona is a news organization, an information provider for, by, immigrants, and that's part of our mission. And immigrants and an immigration coverage can have many faces. I am an immigrant, and I'm a very successful person. There is some immigrants that are just crossing the border. There is a lot of nuances to that term that we use very lightly in the United States. When I'm doing those interviews, and sometimes me as a human get triggered, sometimes there's people that I have interviewed that have asked me to learn English before doing that interview. And that for me, and sometimes it's a Chicano or Latino who's asking me that. Or it's really hard when we're talking about family separations, when we're talking about kids being raised by their older siblings, when we're talking about what we have seen in Minneapolis happen. And when we're not covering those issues with empathy and dignity, when our guests, they don't have that yet, mm-hmm. because maybe their privilege is blinding them to whatever is going on in the streets, it's really difficult just to stop and breathe and just give the mic. But something that we have done is whenever we're feeling our emotions getting our way, if we have the facts. So we prep a lot for those interviews. Mm-hmm. So when people are saying, it's like, economy has never been better, I do have a number that said, but this is this research that is saying that. Or when it was like, all those immigrants that are being deported are criminals, like, well, mm-hmm. let me show mm-hmm. you the statistics and everything. So we all learn a little bit.
Yes. Your show is, as you have been alluding to, a place where people from a diverse range of perspectives are in conversation, which is not something that is very common on the radio airwaves or television airwaves or TikTok airwaves no. these days. I mean, it's fairly unique, I think.
We look for echo chambers. That's something that we do as human beings. We always want to hang out with the people who think just like us and just bursting that bubble and forcing people to have those very rich conversations is very interesting. It's really hard, but it's so worth it.
Well, I have been speaking with Maritza Felix, who is the founder of Conecta Arizona and the host of the daily show Coffee Time. Maritza, thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you, Sam. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Back in 2024, ASU philosophy professor Owen Anderson filed a lawsuit against the Arizona Board of Regents over what he said was a university-mandated DEI training. He alleged that the training, which was called Inclusive Communities and discussed subjects like white privilege and transformative justice, imposed a worldview based on definitions of race and was therefore unconstitutional. An ASU spokesman at the time denied that the training was a requirement, and Anderson's lawsuit was eventually dismissed by the Arizona Court of Appeals. But now, he and his attorneys at the Goldwater Institute are asking the state Supreme Court to allow the lawsuit to proceed. And in light of the ongoing debate about the role of DEI in academia, we were curious to learn more about Professor Anderson's objections. I spoke with him here in our studios recently, and he told me that he has no problem with the individual components of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, in theory. But, he said,
they're used in order to teach the Marxist dialectic of oppressor versus oppressed, that society is divided into those two groups. And then you can identify those groups based on skin color, which is definitely one of the views out there, but it's not the only way to interpret history or society. And so it shouldn't be given a privileged position in the university as the only view that's taught.
Just to ask, do you feel that there's a way of looking at history where white people don't have a track record of subjugating people with other skin colors?
Well, you'd have to look at particular time periods in history. So certainly are times where that happened. For example, the Atlantic slave trade. But the problem is that it tends to become a very selective interpretation of history in order to fit the Marxist dialectic framework. And so any view that says we're more than just material things, we also include a soul, for example, would give a different interpretation of history.
I suppose, though, somebody who is supportive of the idea that that is the proper framing could say, well, when it comes to, let's say, things like race and gender, there have been historically documented cases where it was, you know, women weren't allowed to have credit cards, for example. And you mentioned the transatlantic slave trade. Like that, obviously, that's a very extreme example, but it is obviously a very real thing. Whereas when it comes to questions of the soul and things of this nature, that's less documentable and provable.
Yeah, that probably is what a materialist would say, but think about the actual arguments that were given against the slave trade. It was that these are human souls, was usually the word that was used. And therefore, slavery, that slave system that was being used, is morally wrong.
Yeah.
But interestingly, for your listeners, I'm excited about talking about these issues, but this is the case that we want to argue in front of the court. But it's not the case we're going for right now. What's in front of the court is, does the content engage in race blame?
But let me ask you about this in the context of your field of study, Professor, because you are a Christian philosopher, right? Mm-hmm. The reason I bring up your field of study is because it strikes me that there could be a sort of a discontinuity between the idea which you're expressing, which is that like this particular moral judgment should not shape the policies of the university. Mm-hmm. But in your classes, presumably, you are arguing for a certain moral framework to guide the belief systems and actions of your students.
Well, no, I mean in my job, I don't do that. I mean my job, let's say I'm teaching an introduction to ethics class right now. I view my job as a philosopher is to help the students think through the major viewpoints that are out there. If anything, you know, you'd label me a classical liberal. I believe you know the state university, which is funded by all the different taxpayers with lots of different opinions, isn't the place where one view should be the only view.
So it seems like this notion of racial blame is the piece of the DEI training that is most objectionable to you. Can you give me an example of like what you encountered in the training that adds up to this idea of race-based blaming?
Yeah, and that really would be that's the only issue. We're not saying Owen Anderson personally doesn't like this training. We're saying this training violates state law, which prohibits race blame. And I think we would normally say, yeah, race blame. Of course you can't judge an entire group of people based on their skin color. But when you get into the training, what I encountered were segments that had to do with the problem of whiteness and white supremacy. And again, we say all of us are against white supremacy, but white supremacy defined as if you're white, you're a white supremacist because you either are consciously one or you're unconsciously one.
Okay, but supporters of DEI trainings like this talk about it as not an assignment of blame, but rather an introduction to people who may not be familiar with these things, a sense of context, some historical context for the lived experiences of people who do look like them and who don't look like them. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it is an inherently negative thing to give people that kind of context?
No, not at all. And I think any good teacher intuitively does that already with the classroom they're in. What I'm emphasizing is the individuality of it. So I don't go into a class and I look at a student and think I know them based on what I can assess.
But so to be clear, let's say that in these training materials, rather than expressing blame towards white people for various historical injustices, there was language to the effect of the United States was founded on the principles of Christianity, and that guides and informs the policies at this university. Would you object to that as well?
You just asked a question. I could say yes or no. You know, most of the people writing and signing the Constitution went to Christian churches. That's true. But then you'll say, well, let's look into some nuances, some of the differences of denominations, some of them who maybe just went out of tradition and they're actually deists. And so you get into some of those qualifications.
But there are similar gradations within whiteness, right? I mean, just as it is probably good for some Christians to know that, hey, you know, like this faith has been weaponized in devastating ways in the past sometimes. Is it not also good for some white people who bear no animus towards other races or anything like that, also be made aware like, hey, just so you know, sometimes people have used the skin color that you just happen to have been born into to do some pretty horrific things.
Yeah. The professor, English professor Shelby Steele, makes this point. He says that slavery wasn't America's original sin. America's original sin was the use of race to gain power, and that it continues to be done by the left today. So they weaponize race in these kinds of training, he would argue.
I'm imagining that somebody listening to this might hear you say, you know, that's what people who support DEI are doing, is using race to gain power. I imagine what they might say is it's not about using race to gain power. It is about acknowledging the role of race in creating a power imbalance.
Yeah. Well, and they would be right if they said that. But the training and the screenshots we provided show where it goes beyond that. So we can't imagine, like, in our minds, I say, I think DEI training should just be saying this. And maybe you say a true thing, that, yeah, that'd be good training, but that's not what this is, right? So we're only going to court over this training.
So you filed your original lawsuit in 2024?
Yep.
You are, as we're speaking today, still employed by ASU. Mm-hmm. You have not taken the training?
Well, I did take it, but I didn't complete the quizzes.
You didn't complete
and
the quizzes.
And they did take the quizzes down right away. They agreed because that does compel speech. This is one of the things you can't do as an employer. You have a limited amount of things you can do, but you can make employees sit through training. But you can't compel speech or belief. And that's where the quizzes stepped over their bounds. So they agreed to that already. But the content—
But why does that not solve the problem? If you effectively sat through a training at the end of which, in your case, there was not a test you had to pass in a literal sense, how does that not address the issues that you're raising?
Yeah, that's a good question, because that's what the basic ASU's lawyers, Perkins Coy, said. I didn't face any harm of any kind. For example, I'm still employed. I didn't like get disciplined or have a letter put in my file or anything like that. But the harm in any other circumstance for anyone else, we would understand the harm was being subjected to racism. So I was subjected to a traumatic experience, which is itself the harm.
Well, I have been speaking with Owen Anderson, who is a professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology at ASU. Professor Anderson, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Arizona isn't really included in lessons about the Great Migration that brought generations of Black Americans out of the South and across the country. But McDell Otha Jackson came here as a girl in the 1940s and moved to South Phoenix. She and her mother and grandmother came from the South to get health care. They'd heard it was being offered to Black people here. Well, McDell became the matriarch of a big family that's still in the Valley today. But after her death a little more than a decade ago, her family grew apart. They stopped gathering for holidays and sold the South Phoenix home she had lived in. That is, until her granddaughter, Shelley Jackson, brought them all back together and filmed them as they attempted to navigate their family history amid loss and gentrification. It's the subject of Jackson's new documentary, Black Emergence, Traveling Mercy to the Desert Sun. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
When folks hear about the Great Migration, they think of people going to Detroit, going to New York. But really, Arizona was a part of that story as well. And what I learned was that there were other families that not only came to Arizona for health care, but they came to access work as well. They came to help build the airport and build some of the like vital infrastructure we actually have in Phoenix today. And I think that that's really remarkable. My family was fleeing the Jim Crow South, which was a place where my family had also witnessed folks be lynched. They were had witnessed segregation in a very brutal way up close and personal. And so when I think about her migrating to Phoenix for healthcare, to me, it's also like they were seeking refuge. They were seeking possibility and opportunity for a greater life for themselves and for the future of their family.
Yeah. So they came to South Phoenix, as you said, this historically Black part of Phoenix. And you grew up born and raised there. What was it like for you? Like, how has this played out in your own life?
Oh, my goodness. Well, one, I love South Phoenix. I feel so incredibly lucky to have grown up in a place that celebrated all of my history and all that I am. I grew up going to the Roosevelt School District, which was a place that I ended up becoming the school board president of. But when I was growing up, my grandma was also a volunteer nurse in the district. And so our family had beautiful roots there. I'll give you an example, a little bit of what it's like to grow up in that neighborhood at that point in time. Martin Luther King Day was like a whole neighborhood holiday. I went to Martin Luther King School, and that whole week leading up to Martin Luther King Day, the whole school was making posters. We were singing songs. We were watching movies about Martin Luther King Day. And then on the actual holiday, the whole neighborhood, including my grandma, because we live right down the street from the school, they will pull out their lawn chairs and they will watch the kids march. And literally the whole school and the school across the street, Percy L. Julian, all the kids would come out with our posters and we will march through the neighborhood just like Martin Luther King did. And the neighbors and the families would come out on the lawn chairs and they would be cheering us on and singing along. And that's just like a small snippet of an example of what it was like to grow up in that time frame. Yeah. But I felt very loved, loved by my school, loved by my community, and loved by my family.
How have I never heard that? That's amazing.
Yes, you should look it up. It was on the news and everything. I remember feeling like a celebrity.
Marching down the streets. That's amazing. So, and it sounds like your grandma was kind of a big part of that, that sense of community that you had as a kid in South Phoenix. Tell us about just like, what was she like?
Yeah. As I mentioned, she was always my muse. When I was in third grade, I actually brought her to show and tell for Black History Month.
Like she was your show
and tell. Yeah, exactly. I brought in my grandmother and made her tell everyone about herself.
That's awesome.
But she was such a pillar in the community. Everyone would always stop by for a snack, would stop by to ask her opinion on things, to ask for her perspective. She was also a foster parent. Mm-hmm. So I grew up with other kids in and out of the house with us that would go to school with us, that would walk to school with us. And when they were, when their time was up at our grandmother's, it was really sad. But then they, you know, got placed in a different home or got reunified. Yeah. And then we would have another kid a couple months later. And so she wasn't just a safe haven for myself and my family, but she was also welcoming in kids all the time and inviting them into this beautiful community she created.
Yeah. So she passed away a little over a decade ago, it mm-hmm. sounds like. And tell us, like, what happened to your family after that, after her loss, like the loss of this matriarch?
Yeah. After my grandmother's loss, our family really disconnected. I think that we didn't have a person anymore to rally around and to bring us all together. But also after she passed, the house ended up being sold. Mm-hmm. So this place that we had all gathered in, you'll see in the film that we talk about how we had all lived together at one point in time. I've lived with so many of my cousins. That is because when someone fell off or they needed support, they would go live with grandma. And that was just the natural piece of our family. And when that was gone, it just, I think we all felt displaced in a way, and we all felt lost. The only time we saw each other in that decade after she passed was for funerals.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, that sort of mirrors each other, right? Like the loss of this family connection and this community and the loss of the house where it all kind of happened. And that sounds like it's not a rare occurrence in South Phoenix today. Like we've seen housing prices go up everywhere across the valley, but in South Phoenix as well.
1,000%. Our family lost our home for, I think, a multitude of reasons. The other family that lived around my grandmother, so when I was growing up, I lived 3-4 minutes away from everyone, okay? I couldn't walk down any street without seeing a family member.
Right, right.
And aside from my grandmother's house, what I had learned was that other family members had ended up just moving out of South Phoenix because they got priced out. Mm. And so us coming together was also a reminder of this extended connection that I don't think we even realized was lost until we gathered.
Yeah. Okay, so in the film, you document this gathering, right? Mm-hmm. Your family coming back together for the first time in a long time. And you kind of talk about these issues together and about the broader kind of forces that brought you there.
Right.
What was it like? What was it like to see everyone, to be all in one place together and to talk about these things that probably are not easy to talk about?
I was, one, so scared. I remember, one, feeling like, is this worth it? Am I a fraud for wanting to tell a family story without talking to my own family in a decade. Like, is this even going to work? Are people going to show up? I was just so nervous to bring people in a space together after being estranged for so long. But once we got there, magic happened. You see in the film, we all start hugging and we're laughing together. We're a very lively family. we all have a really great sense of humor.
It looked like fun.
Yes, it was such a beautiful time. And I want to shout out Black River Life and Colette and Brian, because you'll see that we actually had facilitators there too.
Yeah.
And these were folks who came into the home and supported us through grieving together, supported us through navigating this like really tough conversation that I think was needed. Yeah. I don't think we could have done it alone, but I'm so glad we did, because it actually has changed our whole family dynamic since then.
So, I mean, yeah, where has it brought you? Where is the whole experience of making this film, you know, ended up?
Yeah, so we filmed this September 2024. And after that, we had spent our first family Thanksgiving and Christmas together for the first time in a decade.
Wow.
And it was beautiful and it was magical. And ever since then, now we actually get together on holidays again. We show up for birthdays and celebrations in a way that we just hadn't before. And I think it's really just opened up our hearts and reminded us that even though we've lost a matriarch, we actually all have a responsibility to still show up for each other. And we have a responsibility to reshape what the future of our family looks like.
It's pretty great.
Yeah.
All right. We'll leave it there. Shelley Jackson is the executive director at Instituto and also the director of this short film called Black Emergence, Traveling Mercy to the Desert Sun. Shelley, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Black Emergence, Traveling Mercy to the Desert Sun will be screening this weekend as part of the Living Black Worlds event at Phoenix Center for the Arts.
Celebración Artística de las Américas is a local organization working to support Latinx art through artist residencies, workshops, exhibitions, and more. The nonprofit's current artist-in-residence invites the community to become part of her latest piece. The show's Amber Victoria Singer went to the studio to learn more.
On a recent Friday afternoon, four women gather around a large circular steel loom in a warehouse just east of downtown Phoenix. Music plays softly as they work. It's a mix of country, R&B, and huayno, a type of South American dance music. Incense burns. Snacks and tea are standing by. On one side of the room is a folding table with an array of colorful yarn, rope, and ribbon, as well as scissors and shuttles, the tool for moving material through the loom's threads. This is week four of a series by multidisciplinary artist Samantha Vo, who welded the loom herself.
The loom series is a project I started in November. It started off as a project to bring community together, and then quickly, as I was building the loom, realized it was a sculpture in itself. And so it's become, I guess, a performance piece where I'm inviting people to weave on the loom with me and create community, co-create together, and allow people to just slow down and work with their hands.
Karen Torres Berceta, a 21-year-old artist, is sitting on a stool weaving with teal rope and white yarn.
It kind of looks like the Statue of Liberty's hair. Yes. And I'm just weaving it through this piece right here that I've been working on since the first day.
During the four-week series, the Kaya Alliance Studio is open on Fridays from noon to 3 p.m. for anyone who wants to weave on the loom. The steel loom is about 4 feet tall. It has nearly 150 short steel tabs welded onto two circular forms to hold the warp threads, the vertical yarn that everything else gets woven through. The loom itself stands on the bottom tabs, and the circular forms are supported by four longer steel beams. Torres Berceta shows up every Friday.
When I'm sitting here working, I feel everything. I feel very antsy because you have to sit through it and really see it through. But at the same time, it's just kind of like, okay, just relax.
Zahara Negrete, a 30-year-old artist and actress, is sitting on the floor to Torres Berceta's right. This is her first time weaving.
I really like it. It reminds me a lot of ceramics because it is very intricate. Like when you're hand building something,
Negrete is drawn to the community aspect of the series.
I feel like this is such a fun way to not only get to know yourself, but also like eventually just get to know people around you. And I think that's really cool.
Vo says about a dozen people have contributed to the project.
It's been a very tender experience having people come and weave on the loom with me. The very first people that wove on it was my family. And so now inviting other people to come and learn how to weave has been really special. And I think a great way to like build connections and for people to come together and experience working with their hands in the same way that I do in my practice.
There's not a set way to weave on the loom. Different colors and fiber types overlap without a clear pattern.
It's usually just like very free play, free form weaving, and so people get really into it and start experimenting, which is really cool.
This evening at Grant Street Studios, there will be one more chance to contribute to the loom. Afterwards, Bo will take the weaving off and display it as a tapestry at Kaya Alliance next month. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Amber Victoria Singer.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. I think for two non-weavers, sounds kind of interesting, huh?
I mean, it definitely took me there. And I, if nothing else, would really love to see that finished product once
yeah.
it's done. It
sounds pretty
beautiful.
Interesting. Yeah. All right. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.